Hi, and thanks for joining me for Stories from the Phoenix New Times. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hoprock. First on this week's program, Tax Break Mutant Ninja Turtles, the Goldwater Institute's Hypocrisy. This story was written by Stephen Lemons and was posted on March 24th. The Goldwater Institute, Arizona's premier conservative think tank, claims it cares about nothing more than protecting your tax dollars. The organization is a friend of taxpayer rights, says its website. The taxes you pay, which it argues should be few, should go where they're supposed to. To prove its argument, Goldwater is suing to end Arizona's motion picture production program, which is overseen by the Arizona Commerce Authority. Passed by the Arizona legislature in 2022, the program is meant to spur film production in the Grand Canyon state by offering up to $125 million in tax credits to qualified projects. That's corporate welfare, Goldwater argues. The program provides valuable advantages to private interests, depletes the public treasury, and distorts the market. In a lawsuit filed in Maricopa County Superior Court, Goldwater argues that the program violates the Arizona Constitution's gift clause, which says that the state cannot give or loan its credit in the aid of or make any donation or grant by subsidy or otherwise to any individual, association, or corporation. Never mind, of course, the tax credits that favored the interests of members of the Institute's very conservative board of directors, including tax credits for film production. Goldwater may want to eliminate Arizona's film production credit, but films produced by Goldwater's board chairman, Eric Crown, apparently tapped the very same benefits in another state. On LinkedIn, Crown lists himself as the executive producer of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie, which were partially filmed in New York. Per IMDb.com, Crown earned producer credits on the 2014 live-action reboot of the franchise and its 2016 sequel, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles: Out of the Shadows. Both films acknowledge the support of the New York State Governor's Office for Motion Pictures and Television Development. Phoenix New Times could not verify that the 2014 film received a tax credit, but a September 2016 report from New York's Empire State Development Office noted that the sequel received a credit of $19.2 million. That's around 30% of the film's total of $63 million in qualified costs. The production's total budget reportedly was $135 million. Crown told New Times he wasn't sure what tax credits the films received, but insisted he opposes the state film tax credits in general. "I have been a believer that the government should just make a level playing field," said Crown, the co-founder of the Tempe-based technology company Inside Enterprises. "Don't pick winners and losers." Crown said he has consistently opposed film tax credits like Arizona's, in part because business needs to have a little pressure of profit, loss, and everything else. This strikes him as corporate cronyism when he sees the government handing out free checks. He also said state film tax credits don't work. The jury's out on that. Opponents of tax film credits point to studies such as a 2016 paper from the University of Southern California's Price School of Public Policy. In it, researchers found that such tax incentives did not lead to sustained job creation or wage growth, nor did they lure film production away from the movie-making hubs of New York and California. But supporters of Arizona's film tax credit financed a study that said Arizona would benefit from building big studios planned for the East and West Valley, claiming the credits would realize a fiscal gain for the state by year 7 of the program. The study also claimed the film tax credit was no less constitutional than the ACA's other tax incentives and grants to such industries as steel producers and computer chip manufacturers. Via text, Crown later admitted that New York State tax credits may have been good for his movies, but he didn't know if they were good for the taxpayers. Government shouldn't be subsidizing big business or movie studios, he wrote. Whether the movies were good is another matter. Crown's first TMNT film has a 21% fresh rating on Rotten Tomatoes, while the sequel has a 38% rating. Movies bad, baseball good. Another Goldwater board member may soon benefit from a sweet tax giveaway. Conservative activist and attorney Randy Kendrick is the wife of Arizona Diamondbacks owner Ken Kendrick, who wants tax money to pay for improvements to Chase Field, which is owned by Maricopa County. For years, the county and the Diamondbacks have feuded over who should pay to update the nearly 30-year-old stadium. If a solution isn't found, specifically one that includes a chunk of public money, Ken Kendrick has suggested the Diamondbacks could relocate to another state when the Chase Field lease expires in 2027. To avoid that, the Diamondbacks are backing legislation sponsored by State Representative Jane Weninger. The Chandler Republicans' bill would divert both state sales taxes earned at Chase Field and the state income taxes of Diamondbacks employees, including the players, into a county fund to pay for renovations and major repairs to the plumbing, the ballpark's retractable roof, and the air conditioning system. The Diamondbacks have vowed to contribute $250 million to the fund. But the diversion, which has been approved by the State House and awaits action in the Senate, will be costly to both state and local tax coffers. A fiscal note by the Arizona Joint Legislative Budget Committee estimates that the combined state and local revenue loss will be $15 million per year. Phoenix Mayor Kate Gallego called the plan a major league boondoggle in a recent letter to Governor Katie Hobbs, claiming it could cost taxpayers more than $1 billion over the next 30 years. The Goldwater Institute has not opposed or supported the legislation. Asked whether she found that neutrality inconsistent with Goldwater's stance on the film tax credit, Randy Kendrick drew a distinction between the two scenarios. The Diamondbacks do not own the stadium, but instead lease it, she noted in a text. She said the relationship was the same as between landlord and tenant. In typical common law, the landlord repairs and maintains the buildings they own, Kendrick wrote. This facility is approaching 30 years old and needs some significant infrastructure repairs and maintenance. The legislation is strictly to keep the facility operating in a safe manner for the public. This recaptures certain taxes generated and dedicates them for upkeep of the building. Notably, a 2018 deal with the county granted the Diamondbacks control of booking Chase Field for concerts and other events, and the ability to keep the revenue those events generated. In return, the team assumed responsibility for the stadium's upkeep. Regardless, the film tax credit is another animal, Kendrick said. The tax credit in the film industry program goes to private corporations and individuals. That's an entirely different proposition, she wrote. I hope I've made clear what I think the difference is. Still, there's ample debate about whether public financing for pro sports stadiums is good tax stewardship. During a February 4th hearing about the bill at the legislature, representatives of two ideologically opposed nonprofits spoke against the legislation. Margaret Schultz of the left-leaning advocacy group Worker Power argued that independent research showed a limited positive impact of sports stadium subsidies, which are unpopular with taxpayers. Kevin McCarthy, the president of the Conservative Arizona Tax Research Association, who also spoke against the 2022 film tax credit bill, said local governments would rather keep their taxes to pay for public services and infrastructure improvements. The Chase Field bill would rejuvenate a bad policy tool that should be put to rest, he added. Parker Jackson, a staff attorney with the Goldwater Institute who helped bring the film tax credit suit, told New Times that he was unaware of Goldwater ever taking a stand on the Chase Field situation. Nevertheless, he said the stadium carve-out was different because the county has an ownership interest in the ballpark. As far as the propriety of what's being done currently or what was done when the stadium was built 20 or 30 years ago, he said, I don't have a specific comment on that. Lucy Ducey. Ex-Governor Doug Ducey is another member of Goldwater's board, a fact both unsurprising and, in light of the film tax credit suit, ironic. Though a conservative, Ducey was hardly averse to handing out tax incentives. During his governorship, he co-chaired the Arizona Commerce Authority, which doles out grants and incentives to corporations like Halloween candy. As he left office in 2022, he also proudly announced the ACA had obtained $100 million in federal funds for the benefit of Arizona's semiconductor industry. Goldwater is suing the ACA over the film tax credit. Ducey could have saved Goldwater and the state of Arizona the cost of this litigation by vetoing the credit when it came to his desk during his final year in office. Instead, Ducey allowed the very incentives that Goldwater has characterized online as lavish Hollywood handouts to become law without his signature. Asked if he saw a conflict between Ducey's action on the law and the ex-governor's presence on the board, Jackson said he didn't think so, because Ducey didn't sign it. But Ducey could have vetoed it, right? Sure, he could have, Jackson said. There's all sorts of stuff that happens with legislation and budget negotiations and stuff behind the scenes. I don't have any direct knowledge of that, and it doesn't affect the lawsuit directly. The ACA staff is a controversial institution among conservatives and was the subject of vigorous debate last year when it was scheduled to sunset. Some legislators argued that the agency should be eliminated, and Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays issued an opinion stating that multi-million-dollar CEO junkets sponsored by the ACA clearly violated the gift clause. Ultimately, the legislature reauthorized the ACA through 2029. Jackson said that only the ACA tax credits that violate the gift clause are bad. He added that the Arizona Supreme Court ruled that indirect benefits, such as those touted by supporters of Arizona's film tax credit, don't pass muster. Even if the rosiest of projections are true, and the film tax credit eventually makes money for the state, the credit would still be inappropriate. As the former co-chair of the ACA, Ducey's spot on Goldwater's board might seem an odd fit. It's not. Ducey was largely responsible for the Institute's two big ideological wins in recent memory. One was signing into law the Goldwater-backed expansion of private school vouchers known as Empowerment Scholarship Accounts. The other was instituting a 2.5% flat income tax, which took effect at the beginning of 2023. According to the nonpartisan Grand Canyon Institute, both initiatives are reverse Robin Hood budget busters. The think tank pegged the flat tax's annual cost at $2 billion in lost revenue, claiming that 70% of the flat tax's benefits went to households with incomes above $200,000. ESAs have been a similar giveaway to the wealthy, with an estimated net cost of $429 million for the current fiscal year. The Institute also reported that parents often bank the ESAs, resulting in $360 million in funds, including those carried over from prior fiscal years that have gone unspent. ProPublica reported that the average ESA award of roughly $7,000 mostly went to middle and upper income families who were already sending their kids to private school. Despite that, the Goldwater Institute has crowed about both the flat tax and the ESA expansion. On its website, Goldwater said it was proud to have simplified the state's tax laws and reduced the burden on Arizona's taxpayers with the flat tax. As for the ESAs, Goldwater claimed they're free programs that give every parent in Arizona the power to get their child into a school that fits. Jackson said every state constitution requires funding education, while there's no part of the Constitution that says the state is supposed to fund movies. That's true, though the Constitution does not mandate that the state pay wealthy families to send their children to private academies. Dave Wells, the research director for the Grand Canyon Institute, said ESAs are about privatizing things the government has done, and the flat tax is about reducing the scope of what government is even able to do. Goldwater likes to proffer silly arguments that these things will pay for themselves or lead to massive, dynamic economic growth. If any of that was true, Arizona would probably be the richest state in the country, he added, because we've been doing massive tax cuts since the 90s and are still not at the median level of income in the country. A persuasive anti-tax break argument, perhaps one Goldwater might consider using in court, unless someone needs it to finance a movie about ass-kicking turtles. The program continues now with a story written by Morgan Fisher and posted on March 24th. Hamada pairs with disgraced quarterback Brett Favre on health program. MAGA-aligned Arizona Representative Abe Hamada has been cheering billionaire Elon Musk and the so-called Department of Government Efficiency as they bumble through federal agencies in search of fraud, waste, and abuse. So why is Hamada partnering with a disgraced former NFL quarterback who infamously bilked millions of federal dollars out of the state of Mississippi? That quarterback is Hall of Famer Brett Favre, who co-authored a Monday article with Hamada on the conservative sports commentary site OutKick to announce the Congressional Fitness Challenge. Under the banner of Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s Make America Healthy Again movement, the voluntary program encourages kids to complete physical tests such as a mile run, pull-ups, and curl-ups. As a Hall of Fame professional quarterback and a United States congressman, we come from different arenas, but we stand united by a common concern, Favre and Hamada wrote. America's youth are facing a silent crisis of physical fitness. Childhood obesity has tripled since the 1970s. Physical activity is down. Strength and stamina are declining. A worthy goal, but one has to wonder, would it be possible to promote the program with a former athlete who didn't siphon away millions of dollars meant for needy Mississippi families? A refresher on the Favre scandal, if you've forgotten. In 2022, Favre and 38 other people were sued over a scheme to misspend $77 million in welfare funds that were supposed to go to the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program. It was the largest case of public fraud involving federal money in Mississippi history. The lawsuit revealed that in 2019, Favre pushed state officials to fund a volleyball facility at the University of Southern Mississippi, where his daughter played volleyball. The university's athletic foundation received $5 million in TANF funds, while Favre got $1.1 million in TANF funds for speeches he never made. Prevacus, a drug company in which Favre invested, also received misspent TANF funds. It bears repeating. Money meant to help poor families stay afloat went toward giving Favre's kid a nicer place to play sports. Favre did repay the $1.1 million in speech money, although the Mississippi State Auditor is demanding he pay $228,000 in interest as well. Favre, who has denied wrongdoing and has not been criminally charged, did not respond to an email from Phoenix New Times requesting comment. Neither did Hamada. But while Hamada has sometimes revealed himself as out of the loop on Capitol Hill, he seems to be aware of Favre's scandal. In September, when the ex-Green Bay Packer revealed he had been diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, at a congressional committee hearing about the misuse of TANF funds, Hamada wrote a message of support on social media. Notably, the federal government would like that money back. On March 11th, the Administration for Children and Families, a subsidiary of the Department of Health and Human Services, which RFK Jr. now leads, asked the state of Mississippi to repay almost $101 million related to the case, citing the same fraud, waste, and abuse lingo that Hamada and Doge have been promoting. As they work on making America healthy again, perhaps Favre and Hamada could also work on making Mississippi pay up. Amid Trump's anti-DEI fervor, dozens honor Native vet Lori Piestewa. This next story was written by TJ LaHerue and was posted on March 24th. Last week, the Trump administration attempted to whitewash the unique contributions of Native Americans to the U.S. military by deleting web pages dedicated to the Navajo Code Talkers. A few days later, in Phoenix, dozens of veterans of all skin colors and backgrounds gathered at dawn to celebrate the lives of fallen soldiers, with a particular emphasis on Native Americans. At daybreak on Sunday, the surviving family members of Lori Piestewa congregated at the mountain that for two decades has gone by her name. In 2003, Piestewa was killed in Iraq, becoming the first Native American woman, Piestewa was a member of the Hopi tribe, to die in combat while serving in the United States Armed Forces. In 2008, Piestewa Peak was given its current name in her honor. Why do we continue to revisit this painful moment? Why do we have to wake up so early? Piestewa's son, Brandon White Rock, asked to laughter from the audience. Lori's father, Terry Piestewa, who died in 2017, also served, fighting in the Vietnam War. Her mother and daughter, Percy and Carla, also spoke briefly at the ceremony. "It's like a family," Percy Piestewa said to the crowd. "We all come together and learn all new things, and we all disappear again, and then we come back." The event featured a number of Native American customs, a white horse, painted with Hopi and indigenous iconography, walked down the mountain without a rider, which in Native American culture symbolizes a warrior lost in battle. A drum circle of veterans provided music, and the Star Spangled Banner was sung in Navajo. So far, Piestewa's legacy has survived the rancor of the MAGA movement's war against diversity, equity, and inclusion. Her namesake mountain, originally called Venom Doag by the O'odham people who lived in the area before settlers ever arrived, was named Squaw Peak by white people sometime in the 19th or early 20th century. Squaw is a derogatory, racially charged word for young Native American women used by the white settlers who tended to view them as less than human. Name change. 5 years after Piestewa's death, the U.S. Board on Geographic Names officially changed the name to Piestewa Peak. The offensive former name is still in common usage among longtime Valley residents, and it doesn't take much searching to find people begging Trump to change it back. That context wasn't far from the mind of Jim Covarrubias, a prolific Native American painter of Tiwa ancestry and a former U.S. Army officer who was drafted into the Vietnam War. The mountain is an ancient holy site for indigenous peoples, said Covarrubias, who chairs the Piestewa Fallen Heroes Memorial Ceremony. In ancient times, the big crystal rock about 100 feet from the top of the mountain was sacred for the natives. They would touch it four times to bless the womanhood of their family and people who were giving birth to protect them and make a prayer for them, Covarrubias said. We'd all gain so much by being part of our ancient culture and absorbing some of the attitudes about the environment, human rights, women's rights, etc. Since being given its current name, the mountain has come full circle. There have been no signs that anyone with the power to do so wants to remove Piestewa's name from the landmark, but Covarrubias doesn't hold the current occupant of the White House in the highest regard. He blasted the Trump administration's deletion of Navajo Code Talkers webpages from government websites, which was reversed after widespread backlash. It's an egregious affront to the dignity of serving, Covarrubias said. It's just racist. There's no other way to put it. It's just sad that we have to go back to that attitude when there's been so much work done by great Americans of color to try and correct this in a nice, nonviolent way. Organizing the annual ceremony has been a beautiful burden for Covarrubias, which he does to help out his fellow vets. He's grateful that Piestewa's family is willing to let her memory serve as a way to bring people together. They had to let down so much of their privacy and accept all of this attention and go over the stories a thousand times when people always ask the same things. White Rock didn't directly address the currently anti-DEI backlash sweeping the country, but he did make a point to note the importance of his mother's heritage to her story. We all come from a race of warriors, he said, resilient people who fought not just in battle, but fought to preserve our culture, our beliefs, and our way of life. Here's a story written by Chelsea Curtis of AZ Luminaria and posted on the New Times website on March 28th. Trump administration removes report on missing and murdered indigenous people. A critical report created to address the issue of missing and murdered indigenous people in Arizona and across the country has been removed from federal websites as the Trump administration continues to eliminate diversity, equity, and inclusion materials and policies. The report, created under the Not Invisible Act, was hailed as a groundbreaking effort to combat violence and systemic challenges indigenous communities face nationwide. The act was signed into law by President Donald Trump during his first presidency and was the first bill in U.S. history introduced and passed by four congressional members enrolled in federally recognized tribes. Arizona, which is home to 22 federally recognized tribes, was identified in an early study as having the third highest number of indigenous women and girls going missing or being murdered in the country. In 2020, a legislative study found that 160 indigenous women and girls were murdered in Arizona between 1976 and 2018, a total that steadily increased in those 40 years. Additionally, the National Missing and Unidentified Persons System showed just over 90 Native Americans were reported missing in Arizona as of Friday. Arizona Luminaria recently launched an MMIP database where just under 100 women and girls who were missing or were murdered are reflected so far. That data has shown that women ages 19 to 32 accounted for almost half of all the cases, and almost half of the people killed were linked to substance abuse and or intimate partner violence. When he signed the act in October of 2020, Trump touted being the first president to formally recognize the issue of MMIP. He also signed into law Savannah's Act, and in 2019, issued an executive order establishing the Operation Lady Justice Task Force, both of which aimed to combat the ongoing issue. More specifically, the act established a commission of tribal leaders, law enforcement, and federal partners tasked with developing recommendations to improve public safety for Indigenous people. I am so grateful to the members of the Not Invisible Act Commission for the time and effort they have given to this work and this report over the past 2 years. Indian country will be safer and lives will be saved because of this commission's work, said Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland in a November 2023 statement. Everyone deserves to feel safe in their community. Crimes against Indigenous peoples have long been underfunded and ignored, rooted in the deep history of intergenerational trauma that has affected our communities since colonization. Haaland, who helped lead the effort, continued. I look forward to reviewing the recommendations, which will help us continue to galvanize attention and resources toward these tragic epidemics. In 2023, the Commission held a series of public hearings, including in Arizona, to hear directly from communities most affected by MMIP. I always say that I've never received justice for what happened to my daughter because nothing can bring her back, Pamela Foster told the Commission in Arizona in May, according to reporting by Shandon Silversmith of Arizona Mirror. There will never be justice, but we can learn how to move forward in changing laws to make things better for our people. While a web page about the act remained active as of Friday, its final report from November 2023 appears to have been taken down and instead displays a page not found message. The report was last captured and archived by the Wayback Machine on February 8th. Its removal aligns with recent directives from Trump to eliminate DEI-related materials and policies from the federal government. His administration also recently removed webpages related to the Navajo Code Talkers and other Native American veterans, such as Ira Hayes, a member of the Gila River Indian community who fought in the Battle of Iwo Jima, and Lori Piestewa, a Hopi woman and the first Native American woman killed in the Iraq War. It's unacceptable and extremely unfortunate that the many vital contributions of Native American soldiers, including Ira Hayes' bravery during the Battle of Iwo Jima, appeared to have been disregarded by the Department of Defense and other military agencies, Gila River Indian Community Governor Stephen Rowe Lewis said in a statement, calling for every single reference to be restored. To be clear, recognizing the patriotism and courage of Native American soldiers has nothing to do with any type of DEI initiative, he continued. It's simply an offering of respect for extraordinary service and bravery in the line of duty. Following public outcry, some of the web pages have since been restored. You failed. GOP lawmaker blasts MAGA State Senator Wendy Rogers. This next story was written by Morgan Fisher and was posted on March 27th. Editor's note, this story has been updated to incorporate comments made in a press release by State Senator Wendy Rogers. When it comes to far-right state lawmakers, Wendy Rogers and Mark Fincham, it appears State Representative Walt Blackmun is done playing nice. For months, the Republican from Snowflake has been pushing a bill, House Bill 2030, to criminalize stolen valor, the practice of fabricating or exaggerating military service. The bill is personal to Blackmun. A 21-year Army veteran, he has had to survive a primary battle against Steve Slayton, a Donald Trump fanatic who, news reports revealed, had embellished his military record. Blackmun's bill has won bipartisan support, passing 58-0 through the Arizona House of Representatives. But then it reached the Senate Judiciary Committee, which is chaired by Rogers. On the one hand, Rogers is a veteran of the Air Force. On the other, she is closely aligned with Slayton. Wednesday afternoon, after dozens of veterans had traveled to the Capitol to testify in favor of the bill, Rogers unilaterally struck the bill from the committee's agenda, effectively killing it. Later that evening, Blackmun took to X to put her and Fincham, who is also on the committee and supportive of Slayton, on blast. What happened at the Arizona Capitol this week wasn't just political. It was a disgrace, Blackmun wrote, going on to note the Vietnam veterans, Gold Star families, and descendants of the Navajo Code Talkers who traveled to support the bill. Then he turned his fire on Rogers. Senator Rogers, shame on you, Blackmun continued. You swore the same oath I did, to defend the Constitution and uphold the values of integrity and service. The Air Force Academy's honor code is clear. We will not lie, steal, or cheat, nor tolerate among us anyone who does. You violated that code the moment you chose political games over honoring those who served. You failed as a leader, and worse, you failed as an officer. Blackmun also had smoke for Fincham, who did not serve in the military. And to Mark Fincham, when you've laced up a pair of boots, stood shoulder to shoulder with warriors, and felt the weight of combat as part of our armed forces, then you can speak on veterans' issues, Blackmun wrote. Until then, stay in your lane. Stop pulling strings from the shadows to block what you don't understand and never earned the right to represent. Blackmun, Rogers, and Fincham have not responded to requests for comment from Phoenix New Times. But in a statement released after this article was originally published, Rogers blamed Blackmun for the bill not getting a hearing. Representative Blackmun refused to work with my staff on HB 2030, Rogers wrote. I take this seriously, but have concerns Representative Blackmun ran this legislation to hamstring political opponents, rather than hold accountable those who engage in this type of fraud. The Stolen Valor Bill would create penalties that vary from a Class 1 misdemeanor up to a Class 4 felony if a person impersonating the veteran obtains at least $10,000 from the scam, or impersonates a veteran in furtherance of a campaign for political office, per the text of the bill. Additionally, if a person is serving in local office at the time of a Stolen Valor conviction, they must be removed from their office within 10 calendar days after sentencing. That election provision likely is the sticking point. Supporters of the Stolen Valor Bill have pointed to Slayton as the reason for Rogers' lack of support. Slayton, who owns the infamous Trumped store in Sholo, was outed during the 2024 primary for claiming to have seen combat in Vietnam. In reality, he was a helicopter repairman based in Korea. Rogers and Fincham both endorsed Slayton in the primary over Blackmun and fellow state representative David Marshall, both of whom are black. Blackmun and Marshall won. In his Wednesday night missive, Blackmun hinted at that backstory. I didn't fight for this country so politicians like Rogers and Fincham could turn their backs on those who did, he wrote. I will always stand with Arizona's veterans, and I will never stay silent while others try to diminish their sacrifice. And as for the political games, run your attack ads, spread your lies, send your surrogates like Slayton to discredit me with their baseless claims. In her statement, Rogers claimed that she requested that Blackmun alter the bill to mirror federal law, specifically the 2013 Stolen Valor Act, but that Blackmun refused. She said she added the bill to the agenda for Wednesday's hearing in the hopes that he'd change his mind. Instead, he continues a smear campaign, omitting the fact that a repeated good faith effort was made to work with him on this legislation, Rogers wrote. Sadly, it appears Representative Blackmun let a personal vendetta get in the way of honestly fighting for combat veterans. Blackmun's bill isn't entirely dead yet. Earlier this month, Republican Senator Shauna Bullock adopted a strike everything amendment to a liquor reporting bill she's pushed, Senate Bill 1424, replacing its text with that of HB 2030. Bullock's bill has already passed through the Senate, and on Thursday, the House recommended that the new version be passed. I don't know why someone would want to block the hearing of the bill, Senator Bullock told New Times of Rogers' decision. Unfortunately, that's the prerogative of the chairman, so I don't want to get in between the chairman and the members. But sometimes I have to. Whatever happens, Blackmun sounds like he's spoiling for a fight. I'm a decorated combat veteran of the Iraq War. I don't hide, his tweet concluded. You know where to find me. Here's a story written by Stephen Lemons and posted on March 26th. Phoenix cops who beat and tased deaf black man rewarded with day off. On Tuesday, three Phoenix police officers involved in the unprovoked beating and tasing of an innocent deaf black man with cerebral palsy received a light rap on the knuckles from interim Phoenix Police Chief Michael Sullivan, currently among four finalists to be appointed the city's next permanent police chief. Via a press release, Sullivan announced that the three cops involved in the brutal 2024 attack on Tyrone McAlpin would be getting a day off from work, albeit without pay. All three would be issued 24-hour unpaid suspensions for unnamed policy violations, the release stated. Two officers will be required to attend additional de-escalation training. The media advisory did not identify the officers, nor did it state which officer gets to skip de-escalation training. We understand the concerns raised by this incident, and we take them seriously, Sullivan said in the release. The decision to suspend the officers reflects our commitment to accountability and maintaining public trust. But community activists and advocates for criminal justice reform say Sullivan's timeout for his officers sends a different message, that Phoenix cops can manhandle the most vulnerable members of society with near impunity, even when their ill deeds are captured on camera and broadcast worldwide. Elizabeth Venable, a social justice advocate with the Phoenix group Fund for Empowerment, helped the U.S. Department of Justice reach witnesses for its scathing June 2024 report on Phoenix Police's discrimination toward minorities and unnecessary use of excessive force, including deadly force. She noted the irony of the 24-hour suspensions when McAlpin spent 24 days in county lockup on bogus charges ginned up by the same officers. She called it a failure of internal responsibility for violent misconduct that was caught on video by the camera's body-worn cameras. They're essentially receiving no punishment whatsoever, besides losing a day's pay, Venable said. And I think they can afford it. She pointed to the egregiousness of McAlpin's mistreatment, captured on video, first broadcast by ABC 15. If not for that footage, the whole thing might have been completely swept under the rug, Venable said. Instead, the video went viral and helped change the narrative around police brutality. ABC 15 aired the video just a few months after the DOJ released its caustic 126-page report, and the broadcast seemed to confirm the report's myriad tales of unconstitutional policing. The video from police-worn cameras showed officers Benjamin Harris and Kyle Sue responding to a 911 call about a white man causing a disturbance at a Circle K near Indian School Road and 10th Street. Harris and Sue questioned the man as if he were the victim and bought his tale of having been assaulted by McAlpin, who was walking away from the Circle K. The officers took off after McAlpin, jumped him without warning, and wailed on him repeatedly, deploying a taser multiple times into his abdomen as he moaned and screamed. They falsely charged him with resisting arrest, theft, and aggravated assault. McAlpin was in jail for 24 days before the outcry over the ABC 15 report forced Maricopa County Attorney Rachel Mitchell to drop the charges. Deeper issues. McAlpin is now suing Phoenix in federal court after hitting the city with a $3.5 million notice of claim. The lawsuit named Sue and Harris as defendants, along with Officer Jorge Acosta, who the suit says wrote a false report and a probable cause statement to charge Tyrone with stealing his own cell phone. The abuse McAlpin sustained was consistent with the DOJ report, which documented the department's pattern of abusing the disabled. It described one encounter with Phoenix cops eerily similar to McAlpin's, wherein police pressed a deaf man's neck and head down for 20 minutes after restraining him. The officers continued to shout and threaten the man after they were informed he was deaf. Even one of the on-air personalities of Phoenix's rabidly pro-cop talk radio station, KTAR, found McAlpin's treatment to be abhorrent. Everything they did in this video is exactly what the DOJ report is accusing the Phoenix Police Department of doing, said Bruce St. James of KTAR's Bruce and Gatos during a show after the video was published. They literally became an example of it. Longtime criminal justice reform advocate Caroline Isaacs, executive director of the group Just Communities Arizona, also called bullshit on Sullivan's announcement. In the short term, she said, it tells vulnerable communities that cops can victimize them without consequence. In the long range, there is no suspension, there is no retraining, there is no discipline that can root out the deep systemic problems in every single police department that inevitably lead to these kinds of abuses. Sullivan has been the department's version of a substitute teacher since October 2022, when he replaced scandal-ridden former chief Jerry Williams. And though he's undertaken reforms, including instituting a new use-of-force policy, he's unpopular with the rank and file. Notably, the Phoenix Law Enforcement Association, the city's police union, issued a statement in support of the officers once McAlpin's arrest footage went viral. After Mitchell's office dropped the charges against McAlpin, plea blasted the decision. The organization has not yet commented on the suspensions. The defense of obvious police misconduct and Sullivan's rap on the wrists of the officers involved suggests the problem with Phoenix police isn't the need for a reworded use of force policy. There's training, and then there's culture, Isaac said. And what you have with the Phoenix police is a toxic culture. Next, a story written by T.J. LeHeru and posted on March 26th. Five cops punished by Arizona Police Standards Board in March. Driving an ATV through a playground while drunk. Submitting false timesheets. Using a police database for personal reasons. Attempted sexual assault. These were some of the reasons Arizona law enforcement officers were punished last week. On March 19th, the Arizona Peace Officer Standards and Training Board suspended or revoked the certifications of four former and current police officers and temporarily denied a recruit's certification until August 2026. Known as Post, the board licenses all law enforcement officers in the state, and is one of the few agencies in Arizona with the power to discipline police. The 12-member board includes Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays, two rural sheriffs, Phoenix City Council member Kevin Robinson, and Ryan Thornell, director of the Arizona Department of Corrections, Rehabilitation, and Reentry. In 2024, ASPOST opened 48 investigations into officers and punished 43 cops, including for putting the muzzle of a gun to a woman's head, asking two high school girls when they lost their virginity, driving while under the influence, lying to superiors or investigators, and needlessly handcuffing an 82-year-old lady. So far this year, the board has punished 9 current and former officers from across Arizona. It has opened investigations into 10, including 3 ex-Gila River cops for allegedly drunk driving an ATV recklessly around a park with children around, stealing a gun from a traffic fatality scene, and pointing their firearms at each other as a joke. Investigations into the former officers began in January, but the board has already delivered punishment for one, Orlando Ramirez. Ramirez blew a .248 breathalyzer test, 3 times the legal limit, on June 10th after recklessly driving an ATV onto a basketball court and volleyball court at a community park while children were occupying the area, according to ASPOST compliance specialist Michelle Blanco. He also drove over sidewalks and ran over some bushes before he got stuck in a sand volleyball court, according to witnesses who followed him home. After being arrested for DUI, Ramirez pleaded guilty to 1 count of reckless driving on September 12th. Ramirez's lawyer, Chad Smith, told the board, prior to his termination, Mr. Ramirez had an impeccable service record with the department, and this is clearly a lapse in judgment. The board suspended Ramirez's certification for 1.5 years until December 2025. The board suspended Phoenix police officer Brian Alvarado for 6 months for submitting timesheets in which he claimed he worked more hours than he actually did. Ronnie Jacques, a former Surprise Patrol officer, was given a year-long suspension for using a restricted database to look up someone's address while on duty. Jacques pleaded guilty to a misdemeanor for using the database, which is illegal to use for personal reasons. The board also revoked the certification of former Pinal County Sheriff's Deputy Ricardo Garcia, who was sentenced in February to 1 year in Pinal County Jail for attempted sexual assault. New investigations. At its March meeting, the board opened investigations into 4 current or former cops. They are Jacob Kiati, a former officer in the Navajo Division of Public Safety, who was caught in the agency's weight room engaging in sexual acts with another employee while working the graveyard shift in May 2022. He resigned 1 year after the incident. Phoenix police officer Manuel Abeta, who was suspended by the department for 6 weeks after he was involved in a domestic violence incident. On April 6, 2023, Abeta's wife, Maria, said he grabbed her around the throat and slammed her head into a mirror, shattering it. Abeta said Maria slapped him 3 or 4 times, to which he responded by pushing her into the mirror, but he denied putting his hands around her neck. Criminal charges against Abeta were dismissed on June 15th of that year, and prosecution was never pursued against Maria. Joshua A. McCluskey, who was fired by the Arizona Department of Public Safety in September 2024 for an incident that took place in April of that year. McCluskey stopped a commercial truck for driving in the left lane, but proceeded to bargain with the truck driver to see if he would accept a citation for not wearing a seatbelt, which carries a lesser penalty. The confused driver eventually accepted, but the driver's supervisor refuted the charge because the company uses monitors to ensure their drivers wear seatbelts. After seeing the body camera footage, the supervisor contacted DPS Internal Affairs and McCluskey was fired shortly after. Phoenix police recruit Christian A. Medrano, who allegedly hit a parked car in a church parking lot in Sedona in July 2024, but did not stop to give his information to the vehicle's owner. Medrano claimed that he didn't notice striking another vehicle. Phoenix police learned Medrano's registration had been suspended because he did not have car insurance. And that brings us to the end of this week's program. Thanks very much for listening to Stories from the Phoenix New Times. Please stay tuned for additional interesting programs. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hawbrook. Remember that if you missed any of the stories in this program, or any other Sun Sounds program, you can listen to them on demand. Just go to sunsounds.org and click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then, click on On-Demand Podcasts. Scroll down to the program you're interested in, and click on Listen.